You are listening to the Forgotten News Podcast, March 12th, 2021.
But before we begin, here are a few words about a couple of other podcasts that we think you might want to try.
If you like weird and strange history, then I have the podcast for you. My name is Brenda, and I'm the host of Horrifying History. Are you into the dark side of history? Horrifying History tells you about the side of history that people don't normally talk about. We talk about the tales of haunted places, infamous true crimes, cursed items, and unsolved mysteries, and then we look into the science and documentation to see where does the truth actually lie. Want to get spooky with us? Get your Horrifying History fix by subscribing to Horrifying History, which you can find on any major podcast provider.
Targeted, true crime podcast. We tell stories of those who were targeted by abuse and investigate cases of family violence, using academic research to interpret the events. I think we need to stop making family violence a secret. Let's use our stories to help, heal, and provoke change. Season 4 features the case of Marsha Brantley, a woman who disappeared in 2009 but was not reported missing until 6 months later. With new interviews, we'll explore the possibility that Marsha's husband had isolated her through coercive control from family and friends. Targeted True Crime Podcast. Peace, my friends. Peace.
Welcome to the Forgotten News Podcast. This is your window to hear true stories from long ago. Stories that once made headlines. Stories that people thought would be unforgettable. Yet those stories were soon lost in the sands of time or were buried deep in the dustbin of history. In this podcast, we shake off the sand and dust from those stories and share them here with you, as fresh as the day they were first told.
And now, here's your hosts.
Hello, everyone.
Welcome to episode 49 of the Forgotten News Podcast.
This is Jim.
This is Jessica.
And this is Kit Karen. Hi, listeners.
Well, here we are. But, the episode is late. Again.
Oops, we did it again.
Yeah, and we aren't happy about it. Because the fact is, we were actually hoping and planning to have 2 episodes in February.
And obviously, that didn't happen.
However, we are going to try really hard to record and release at least 1 more episode in this month, March. And our goal from here on out is going to be 2 episodes per month.
Now, we want to be clear. We might not always reach that target, but we are going to try our best.
But the thing that you really need to know is this. Anytime that we don't reach that goal, it will always be for a good reason.
Like, for example, this episode is late, very late, because it took a very long time to pull all of the details together and then to write and record the entire thing as a story for you to be able to hear. And in that context, one other thing that you need to know is that nearly all of our featured stories are taken from original sources, such as newspaper articles from the time period or official government documents, and not books or other people's websites or secondhand sources, such as Wikipedia or whatever. Now, sometimes there are exceptions to that, such as, for example, our previous episode regarding certain 20th century psychics and their predictions. We got our sources from everywhere that we could find them.
However, on this episode, the one that you are listening to right now, our featured story is taken entirely from articles that were published in newspapers at the time of the chain of events, as well as other original documents, such as the U.S. Census from the 19th century and other official records that help to give background information about the people at the center of the story. Now, listeners, I first stumbled across this story in 2018, and it took from then until now to pull the entire story together, or at least enough information for the story to be told on this episode.
And on that note, before Jim has a chance to put our audience to sleep with any additional information about how we put these episodes together, we will move on to the featured story, because obviously that is why you're listening.
Okay, moving on. We will begin, as usual, with...
We're gonna do a warning. So, listen closely.
Appearances can be deceiving. You will sometimes hear people say that good things come in small packages, but no one ever tells you that bad things can come in good packages too. What appears to be sweet and innocent is sometimes not. A pretty face can hide a devil inside.
And that is just a little taste of what our story is all about.
On this episode, we will be presenting a true crime story that revolves around a young married couple. The story takes place in the U.S. between the years 1869 and 1871, partly in northern Ohio and partly in Maryland. Now, unfortunately, it would be extremely hard for us to lay out any sort of detailed warning without giving away nearly the entire story in advance. In fact, the truth is, we sometimes get complaints from listeners that our warnings are too much like spoilers. Like when someone is talking about a movie or TV show, but ruins it for you by telling the entire plot. And for that reason, we are going to try to avoid doing that, beginning with this episode. So, here's what we are going to say instead. Our featured story will include mentions of tragedy and violence, specifically including prostitution, deception by a spouse, obsession, stalking, and a fatal gunshot. Nevertheless, since this podcast does not indulge in gruesome or gory details or foul language in regard to any topic, the specific facts will be told in a manner that is both respectful and historically accurate. But even so, if you think that by hearing about these things, you might have a negative emotional reaction, then this episode is probably not something that you should listen to.
Now, by the way, we want to be crystal clear that we are fully aware that in the present day, the phrase sex worker is generally preferred over the word prostitute, especially on podcasts and other independent media. However, in the 19th century, the term prostitute is the word that was most commonly used in newspapers, police reports, judicial decisions, and other written material. So, whenever we quote from something, we will use whatever terminology was in the original material.
Which means, in a nutshell, that we will be using these terms interchangeably.
Now, speaking of warnings, we will give one more. And hopefully, this is already obvious, but I will say it anyway. This is not a story that children should be listening to. Period. So, if any little ears happen to be nearby, I strongly recommend putting on your earbuds or headphones. However, if neither of those are available to you right now, then simply listen later, when you are just by yourself.
Parental discretion is very strongly advised.
Also, we have one small additional thing that we want to clarify. There will be a couple of times in which specific amounts of money are mentioned and the value of that money in the present day. Now, here is the thing we want to be clear about in regard to that. We simply mean the purchasing power of that same amount of money in comparison to the present day.
Now, one last thing. The featured story will be narrated by our lovely and extremely talented co-host, Jessica Malone, who is also the host of the wonderful storytelling podcast, Motor Mouth Radio. And in addition to Jessica, there will also be a few guest voices here and there along the way.
So, finally, with all of that having been said,
on with the show!
Most men lead lives of quiet desperation. That observation was written by the philosopher Henry David Thoreau in 1854. Quiet desperation. The man who is at the center of our story would definitely have known the meaning of that phrase, although it is highly unlikely that he had ever read even a single sentence of Thoreau in all of his life. This was a man with all the nagging dullness of a humdrum existence, until he met the flirty, beautiful young woman that he soon married. However, He had no way to know that within about a year, she would give him more excitement than he could ever have imagined. But, very unfortunately, not in a good way. Our story begins on February 23rd, 1869, with the marriage of Andrew Bowder and Jenny Norris, following a whirlwind romance that had begun only a few weeks earlier at the beginning of the Christmas season. Andrew was employed as a receiving clerk and dispatcher in the freight office of the Cleveland and Pittsburgh Railway Company. This was a steady job with a good salary. He was respected and well-liked among his co-workers as well as in the neighborhood where he lived. Andrew was also a veteran of the American Civil War, having served with the Union Army in the Ohio Infantry from 1862 until his discharge at the end of the war in 1865. The wedding of Andrew and Jenny had taken place at the Methodist Episcopal Church in downtown Cleveland, to which he belonged. Andrew was 27 years old at the time of the marriage. In contrast, Jenny, his new bride, had just recently became 19. Now, at this point in time, there was nothing particularly remarkable about this couple. But the following year, in March, the Cleveland Plain Dealer would comment that Andrew had courted and married Jenny, quote, under the influence of some unaccountable infatuation, unquote. And about a month after that, Andrew would tell a reporter for the Cleveland Daily Herald that Jenny had attracted his attention because
she was rather good looking and always nicely dressed.
Another reporter gave a physical description of Jenny.
She extends about 5 feet, 2 inches, upward from the floor, and is very slender, with bright green eyes and long blonde hair.
Unfortunately, we know very little about what Andrew looked like, except that according to an article in the Toledo Blade, he had a very boyish appearance, which made him look much younger than his actual age. However, there is no doubt about one thing in regard to Andrew. It had taken less than a week after he first met Jenny for him to become head over heels in love with her. And according to Andrew, as well as all published descriptions, they lived happily together during the year following their marriage. But, notwithstanding the fact that Jenny was almost a decade younger than Andrew, she was very wise to the ways of the world. In fact, she was probably much more wise than Andrew. It is unclear as to precisely what Jenny had told him about herself or her background. However, it is very unlikely that anything she told him was the truth, because entirely unknown to Andrew, Jenny had earned her living as a prostitute, and that this had been her occupation for the past 3 years, beginning at some point after she had turned 16. In fact, in the words of one local cop, patrolman Thomas Riley, who was very familiar with Jenny,
she was as approachable as a park bench.
On April 28, 1870, the Plain Dealer was even more blunt when it published an article which referred to her as
a notorious Cleveland prostitute, commonly known as Tragedy Jenny.
Unfortunately, this very intriguing nickname was never explained. not at that time or at any subsequent time. Andrew did not learn any of this noteworthy information until about a year after they became husband and wife. So, in plain English, Jenny was not a naive, innocent angel at the time of their marriage. Regardless of anything that Andrew might have believed. Nevertheless, according to the same article in The Plain Dealer, quote, she lived with Andrew as a faithful wife, unquote, in a comfortable, respectable home during the year that followed their marriage. But at some point during those months, Jenny appears to have gotten bored. And in the words of a reporter for The Plain Dealer, quote, at length, she was drawn back to her former life of infamy, unquote. Specifically, on March 14, 1870, while Andrew was at work, Jenny packed her belongings and left, together with a friend named Emma Ball. Unfortunately, there is very little background information about Emma, and the information that we do have is hazy. According to The Plain Dealer, she was, quote, a loose woman, unquote. This is a phrase that was often used in the 19th century in newspapers and books as a way of implying that a particular female was promiscuous in her interactions with men, or possibly that she was a prostitute. However, in contrast, the Toledo Blade did not make any such unsavory insinuations in describing Emma. Instead, it merely referred to her as, quote, a woman who had left her husband, unquote, at some unknown point before the start of the chain of events with Jenny. Now, by all accounts, it appears that Emma had been planning to leave town. She evidently coaxed and convinced Jenny into also leaving. So, together, Emma and Jenny secretly hatched a plan. Then they set a date to just disappear. And that date would be March 14th, 1870. The day began uneventfully. Jenny cooked breakfast just as she always did, and then she and Andrew sat down and ate together. However, for some reason, throughout that morning, Jenny had been extremely sweet and affectionate towards Andrew. In fact, so much so that it made him wonder if she was pretending. But he kept that random doubt to himself because he could not think of any possible ulterior motive. So, instead, he simply decided that she must have just woken up in a good mood. Then, later that morning, when it was time for Andrew to leave for work, Jenny kissed him goodbye at the door as usual, and a moment or two afterward, she smiled and said very pleasantly that perhaps at around noon, she would come down to the railroad office and they could eat lunch together. Andrew told her that he liked that idea. However, in the afternoon, the vague suspicion which Andrew had in the morning began to grow and grow and grow. Especially after Jenny did not come to the railroad station. And it turned out that Andrew had good reason to be suspicious, because, unknown to him, almost as soon as he had left for work, Jenny had put her clothes and other belongings into a trunk. She gave another trunk to Emma for her things. And then they just took off to a location that was unknown to anyone except themselves. Then, once Andrew came home from work, he very quickly figured out that Jenny had gone away, with no intention to ever return. Basically, long story short, the fact that all of her clothes and personal possessions were gone, as well as that the door to the house was locked when he arrived home from work, had made it beyond obvious that she had left. The next day, Andrew went to the bank, where he regularly deposited his paychecks, and there he discovered that Jenny had withdrawn everything. Over $100. This was the equivalent of approximately $2,000 in the present day. So, at this point, he was a little shaken up, and for that reason, he went to the police to ask for help, to track down and find his missing wife because, quote, he was determined to reclaim her, if possible, unquote. At the police station, he was sent to a detective named Schmidt, who, by coincidence, was quite familiar with Jenny. He gently attempted to convince Andrew to just let her go. Now, it is unclear exactly what Detective Schmidt told him about Jenny, but it appears that either Andrew didn't believe him or he simply didn't care. And thus, in compliance with his wishes, the police launched an investigation. So, beginning the next day, several detectives went out and snooped and asked questions of practically everyone who knew or was friends with Jenny, as well as anyone who had, worked with her. Andrew began asking questions too. He soon learned from his neighbors that a professional gambler named Harry Anderson had frequently been to his house when he was not home. Andrew felt like he'd been kicked in the stomach because,
I loved my wife, and I had always supposed that she was true to me.
However, in April, approximately 1 month after the disappearance, it was Andrew, not the police, who discovered the whereabouts of Jenny and Emma. It happened like this. Andrew came home from work one day. Then, while coming into the house, he randomly happened to think about the fact that Jenny had taken the two trunks. So, he decided on a hunch that the next day, while at work at the railroad office, he would investigate as to whether Jenny and Emma had taken a train to anywhere. He merely needed to check if they had filled out claim cards for the trunks or other baggage. And, indeed, it turned out that they had. In fact, Andrew thereby learned that Jenny and Emma were, that very same day, riding on a train to Baltimore, Maryland. Andrew informed the police, and then, at the suggestion of Detective Schmidt, he got on the next available train to Baltimore. The police in Cleveland immediately sent telegrams to the Baltimore police telling them to be on the lookout and to hold the women as they were in possession of stolen property, specifically the two trunks. They were also informed that Andrew, the husband of Jenny, was on his way and that he would be there very soon. The next part of the story was told by an article in a Baltimore newspaper.
The matter was put in the hands of Chief Detective Crone, who placed Detective Mitchell, renowned for his gallantry, on the watch for the ladies. They arrived, and upon ordering a carriage, they were astonished when Mitchell asked the privilege of riding with them. However, he soon overcame their objections and carried them to the office of the chief detective, who ordered them to be detained at the police station until the arrival of the injured husband. He came, and the parties were placed face to face.
Now, if you thought, at this point, that Andrew and Jenny were going to have a tearful embrace and work things out, well, you would be wrong. Instead, the thing that actually happened next was that...
As soon as Jenny saw Andrew, she charged at him and landed a sucker punch on the jaw that knocked him down and knocked the fight right out of him. Then, after he got up, Jenny looked directly at Andrew. She then poured upon his head a shower of angry words.
You, you're the reason that I'm here. You're the reason that the policeman grabbed me and then practically dragged me here to the police station. I was minding my own business, just standing on the sidewalk, waiting for a cab. And as soon as the cab stopped and I got in, a policeman jumped inside and sat next to me. And then he told the driver to take me here, to this horrible place, locked in the jail, for as long as it took you to arrive. All because of what reason? Just because you wanted to talk to me? Well, good. Now we could finally have true honesty between us.
Do you remember how we met?
I accidentally slipped and fell on the sidewalk.
As you were coming out of church?
You rushed over to help me up. And thankfully... Oh, so thankfully. That was the way we met.
You didn't know that on the day before.
I had been released from the workhouse.
After being incarcerated for 30 days. Because I was found guilty of being a common prostitute.
That is what the law calls it.
I didn't have a penny in my pocket. But... I was pretty sure you did. So, I had a feeling it would be a good investment for me to get to know you a little bit better. I pretended to feel faint. You helped me sit down on a bench. We sat next to each other. And it didn't take very long for me to find out all about you. I made sure we had several more accidental meetings. And the girl you met, the girl you thought you knew, the girl you know as I?
Well, I just made her up. Sweet, innocent, devout. I am none of those things.
I am the opposite of everything I pretended to be. You fool.
I think that you must be the most ignorant man I've ever met. You had no idea I was play-acting.
As your docile little wife. I simply pretended.
I acted as if I were a simple-minded servant girl. And you, you blind idiot.
You believed
every bit of it.
The more stupid I pretended to be, the more you believed it.
You just ate it up. Well, that play is now over.
It's gotten too boring to continue. I am done with it. And I am done with you.
Now, at this point, according to the article,
the only reply that the man made was to beg her to return to their home. He said, "Return, return to your desolate home." But the wicked woman laughed at his honesty. She repeated the fact that she had started out in a career of vice and had done so before he met and wooed her and won her. She stated that she had been of public ill fame and would always be.
I knew how to make money on my own long before I met you. I've always known how to flutter my eyes in a certain way, and men will almost fall over themselves to give me money. Do you understand me?
And, in case you don't,
I will make it plain. We are through. We are through. We are through. Now, please,
tell these policemen to let me go, just the same way you told them to pick me up. Because it's you
and I have no further business to discuss.
At this point, Andrew changed the subject.
He accused Jenny of robbing him. She replied that she was glad she had robbed him and would do it again.
Now, according to the article,
this was a nice case of conjugal felicity for Chief Crone to settle, but he was equal to the occasion, and by his advice, the woman surrendered the property of the husband. The couple then had a conversation, and, for a consideration, the woman went before a magistrate and signed a relinquishment of her rights as a wife and promised to make no claim on her husband as such. After the matter was settled, he again asked her to return, but she laughed in his face. Andrew returned home, a sadder, if not wiser, man.
However, that was not the end of the article. The final sentence is bittersweet and, sadly, prophetic.
Jenny went on her way to infamy and degradation and woe and death, with an eager step and a light heart.
But, according to a later article in the Toledo Blade, Andrew did not actually return home at this point. He somehow had learned of the hotel at which Jenny and Emma were staying in Baltimore. Andrew went there and begged Jenny to come back. He begged her and begged her and begged her to return and live as husband and wife once more. Evidently, she agreed, but on condition that they would have a new start in a different city. And so, according to the Toledo Blade, quote, it was arranged for them to go to Pittsburgh and keep house there. They left for Pittsburgh accompanied by Emma Ball, unquote. However, after they arrived in Pittsburgh, it was then necessary for Andrew to return to Cleveland to arrange the move. But he learned soon afterward by a telegram from the landlord that Jenny and Emma had both left. And so, once again, Andrew had no idea where Jenny was. However, he soon wondered if she might have traveled somewhere by train like she did before. So, for the next few days, whenever a train from Pittsburgh stopped in Cleveland, he would ask questions of the conductors and porters. Eventually, he learned that Jenny had gone to Toledo, Ohio. And, in addition, according to the information he had gotten from the trainmen, she was living with Harry Anderson. This was the same man whom his neighbors had said had been spending a lot of time at his house with Jenny while he was at work. So, then, in light of all of these facts, on Saturday, April 23rd, Andrew went to Toledo. He actually knew where she was living thanks to the information that the trainmen had given him. Jenny and Emma had moved into an apartment building soon after arriving in the city. However, according to the Toledo Blade, unknown to them,
their apartments were adjoining the residence of a policeman who suspected, from what he had observed, that the women were prostitutes, as they were visited frequently by men who were not of the best character.
The officer soon decided that he would keep his eyes open and put a stop to the situation at his earliest opportunity. And then, completely unexpectedly, that very same evening,
he noticed an unknown man standing in the hallway, knocking on the woman's door. It being dark, the woman opened the door in response to the call, holding a light in her hand. Instantly, to the surprise of the officer, the woman blew out the light and greeted the stranger with kisses and a fond embrace. There was a hush in the woman's room, which in the darkness seemed more profound. Then there was a stir, and a man darted out of the door and down the stairway. Here the officer stepped forward and demanded of the man, who had been greeted so affectionately, his name and the purpose of his visit. He turned indignantly upon the officer with an air which showed that he considered such questions an insult, replying that the matters, of which he had inquired, were none of his business. The officer then informed the indignant man that he was a member of the police force and had a right to ask what he had. Without another objection, the stranger, with a tone and manner which told of the pain which burned within his breast, then explained to the officer that he was the husband of the woman who stood by his side, that his name was Andrew Bowder, and that he had come from Cleveland in search of his wife, who had left him. The officer then informed Bowder that his wife was a bad woman and that she needed looking after, and he thereupon left the couple to themselves.
This description by the officer reasonably matches the chain of events as outlined by Andrew in an interview with a reporter for the Toledo Blade. According to Andrew, when Jenny saw him at the door, she seemed glad to see him and expressed a deep sorrow for what she had done. But, nevertheless, a brief argument erupted between them. Andrew stormed out of the apartment. Jenny ran after him. Evidently, it was at this point that they encountered the policeman, and, shortly afterward, the couple somehow managed to reconcile. Jenny then agreed to return to married life if Andrew would move to Toledo. So, the following night, he returned to Cleveland to pack up their furniture and other household goods and have them shipped to Toledo. However, just before he left on the train, Jenny told Andrew that she was out of money. So he took out his wallet and gave her $20, which is the equivalent of approximately $400 in the present day. Andrew then went back to Cleveland and thought that he would work for a few days. But his troubles with Jenny created so much distraction in his mind that he could not pay attention to his job. One day, he was so totally out of focus that he sent two boxcars of freight to the wrong place. It was at this point that he came to the clear realization that he could not get the situation with Jenny out of his head. And, for that reason, Andrew went to his boss and told him that he was unfit to work and quit his job. He decided to return to Toledo to find employment and live with his wife. So, with this goal in mind, he arrived in Toledo on April 25th or 26th. However, according to Andrew, quote, "Shortly after arriving, I heard that my wife had left," unquote. The same person also told him that Harry Anderson had threatened to kill him if he laid hands on Jenny since he had known her long before Andrew. Unfortunately, it is unknown exactly who had told him these things. Perhaps it was one of the railroad workers who had previously given him reliable information about Jenny. However, regardless of the source, Andrew later said in an interview with a newspaper reporter that because of this information, he now feared that he might be attacked by Anderson. So, he purchased a small pistol to defend himself. Then, one or two days later in Toledo, at approximately 3 o'clock in the afternoon, on Wednesday, April 27th, 1870, Andrew was walking down the street on which the apartment house was located. Suddenly, he thought he saw his wife entering the front door. He wasn't entirely certain. And, by coincidence, at approximately the same time, he happened to notice a small African-American boy, 8 years old, who was standing nearby. The boy was the son of a family that also lived in the building. He asked the boy to check and see as to whether the well-dressed woman was Jenny Bowder. The boy complied with his request and entered the building. But after he saw the woman, he told her that there was a man on the corner that was asking about her. Meanwhile, Andrew was waiting outside, where he was becoming increasingly impatient and irritated when the boy did not return quickly. So, he walked over to the building and entered it. The boy's mother, Mrs. Edwards, happened to see Andrew as he came to the door of the apartment where Jenny lived. Mrs. Edwards described the meeting of the couple as being, quote, very affectionate, unquote. However, since they had begun to engage in conversation, she left them alone. But just a few minutes later, according to the Toledo Blade, Mrs. Edwards, who was standing in a nearby room, was startled to hear the sound of a gunshot. She rushed into the front room of the apartment and was horrified to see Jenny Bowder laying flat on her back on the carpeted floor. Her head was underneath a stand that held a water basin which stood in front of a mirror. Mrs. Edwards quickly bent down and raised the head of the sprawled woman. She immediately saw blood flowing out of the bullet hole on the left side of her head. The noise of the shot from the pistol was loud enough that it was heard by neighbors in other apartments, as well as by many people on the street outside. So, as a result, a small crowd quickly gathered around the building, quote, in great excitement, unquote. A police officer who happened to be on patrol near the building also heard the gunshot, and so he immediately ran towards the entrance. Then, as the policeman came near to the crowd, Andrew Bowder walked out of the front door and presented himself to the officer, who instinctively reached the conclusion that he was the man who had fired the shot. He immediately arrested Bowder and took him to the police station and placed him in a cell. Then, later the same day, in an interview with a reporter, Andrew laid out the chain of events that led to the shooting.
I entered the room, and my wife was arranging her clothing. We kissed each other and talked over our troubles. While I was standing at her side, I recognized her sleeve studs as a pair belonging to Anderson. In that instant, I burned with a terrible madness. I pushed her arm away from me, and the next instant, I know not what I did, except that I left the room and was on my way to the station house when a policeman met me.
And thus, in the words of Edgar Allan Poe, a year of love forgotten in the hatred of a moment. Doctors were called to the scene of the crime and promptly arrived. But upon examination, they determined that the wound that Jenny had received would soon be fatal. So, according to the Toledo Blade, quote, her clothes were loosened and a pillow was furnished to enable the gasping, speechless victim to be made as comfortable as possible. And even though the woman moved her limbs, turned her head from side to side, and breathed with a noise that was a mix of a painful groan and a chilling rattle until her bosom rose no more, it was evident that her earthly days would soon be over, unquote. In this context, it was also noted by the Toledo Blade that once the news spread through the streets that a prostitute had been shot, then almost immediately, quote, several of the females of the city who are engaged in a life of forbidden indulgence gathered on this occasion to render what assistance they could. Unquote. The time from the firing of the fatal shot until Jenny passed away was approximately 1 hour and 30 minutes. Shortly afterward, her body was taken to the police station, and upon learning this fact, Andrew Bowder expressed a desire to see the corpse. The request was granted by Captain Scott at about 8 o'clock in the evening, and then Andrew was taken to the room where the body was located. According to the Toledo Blade, quote, he gazed at it with an air of indifference, and for several minutes not a word was spoken until the husband suddenly made some inquiries about the location of the wound. He was shown the bullet hole, and then he pushed back the hair to see the bloody gap with a quietness of nerve that would thread a needle. There was not a quiver about his lips, nor a shadow of change in his countenance. Unquote. He then calmly turned away and said,
it's too bad. I wish it had been myself.
At this point, Bowder asked for permission to write some letters. The request was granted, and he was allowed to sit at a desk in the captain's office where he wrote 3 letters to friends. He was afterwards returned to his cell, where he first smoked a cigar, then went to sleep. The next day, in response to a telegram sent by the coroner, Bowder's father came to Toledo the next morning. According to the Toledo Blade, the father was greatly upset upon learning the details of the case, but nevertheless, quote, he seemed to sympathize deeply with his son, and then, after conversing with him, he proceeded to consult with an attorney about the case. Unquote. The county coroner almost immediately began an inquest in regard to the death of Jenny Bowder, in which sworn testimony was heard from all persons who had any first-hand knowledge in regard to the killing. The coroner also examined the letters and papers that were found on her person and elsewhere within the apartment. Unfortunately, the inquest did not uncover anything that was not already known. The coroner ruled, after examining the body and studying all of the available evidence, quote, quote, that Jenny Bowder had come to her death from receiving a wound in the head by means of a bullet that was fired from a pistol by the hand of her husband, Andrew Bowder, with intent then and there to kill the aforesaid Jenny Bowder, also known as Jenny Norris, unquote. He thereupon ordered the city undertaker to bury her body in the city cemetery. But, from this point forward, there was almost nothing that was printed about Andrew Bowder or the killing of his wife until approximately 6 months later, when several newspapers in Ohio published a very strange story containing a quote from Bowder. The source of the story is unclear. Perhaps he wrote a letter to a newspaper or possibly had an interview with a reporter. But, regardless of where the story had come from, here is the context for the quote. According to these articles, Bowder said that he recently had a dream in which Jenny spoke to him. He said that this dream had given much relief to him and that, upon waking up, he felt compelled to write a description of the visions and feelings that had come to him in the dream.
The image of my heart appeared to me, and while loving thoughts of my mind did train, she still seemed the delirium of my brain. Gracefully and lovingly, she sat in my cell, cheering me up and wishing me well, saying, you have forgave me, and now I can be a guardian angel over thee, and watch and shield you to the last, while you through this wicked world do pass. And as you ride life's stormy sea, I will serve as a compass unto thee, and watch and be with you from hour to hour, removing each thorn, and instead place a flower. Those thoughts I cherished, but not in vain, for they were as dewdrops from heaven, cooling my brain. Each word seemed more precious to me than pearls of the ocean or gems of the sea.
Now, after the publication of this extremely weird story in which Andrew and Jenny reconcile in a dream, there seems to have been nothing that was printed about the real-life Bowder case until early February, when he was finally brought to trial. He was charged with murder. He had been sitting in jail for nearly a year. The lawyers for Bowder did not deny the basic charges against him. Instead, they attempted to have the charges dismissed on the basis that Bowder had been a victim of temporary insanity. And in support of this defense, there was testimony from witnesses that his mother was of unsound mind and that he had inherited some of those traits. In addition, there was expert medical testimony that Bowder was insane at the time that he shot his wife. The judge listened patiently to the arguments by the defense, but he ultimately denied the motion. The judge evidently agreed with the position of the prosecution that Bowder should not be considered insane, merely from the undisputed fact that his actions and personality were often peculiar. This was also the opinion of an editorial published in the Toledo Blade, which reflected the apparent reasoning of the judge. Quote, Bowder was sane enough that he did not need to be looked after and restrained by friends who professed to have been long acquainted with his proclivity to rash and dangerous deeds. He was sane enough to be trusted as a railroad employee, to be reasoned with and chided by his friends as a rational and responsible being, instead of being restricted and watched over as an irresponsible and dangerous person. Bowder is not probably of the strongest intellect, and in his adult years, his life has been one of cultivation of bad passions and unsavory associations, as well as great willfulness and self-indulgence. It is these excesses that have brought him to grief and shame. Unquote. Now, at this point, after the insanity defense was rejected, the lawyers for Bowder attempted to argue that the killing of his wife was excusable because it was a spontaneous reaction to his discovery that she had been unfaithful, and for that reason, it was justifiable. The next day, the Toledo Blade published an editorial in which it expressed its disgust with this argument. Quote, it will not do to say that in cases where the relations between the sexes are concerned, the liberty to take a life can be allowed more greatly than in other cases. Human life must be made more secure. We must not allow the temple of justice to be fired with fuel that is stolen from the altars of charity and mercy. Unquote. The case was eventually given to the jury, which declared Andrew to be guilty of manslaughter for the deadly shooting of Jenny Bowder. Now, the verdict of manslaughter was a complete surprise at the time, particularly because nearly every newspaper article, beginning from the day after the arrest of Bowder, used the term murder in mentioning him, or specifically referred to him as, quote, the murderer, unquote. So, after the verdict, the newspapers apparently decided to forget all of that and, instead, simply contented themselves with the fact that there had been no ruling of insanity that would have let Bowder off the hook, and also that the jury had not been swayed by the attempt by the lawyers for Bowder to justify the killing on the basis of the so-called unwritten law, which supposedly excuses a spouse from punishment in cases involving adultery or unfaithfulness by the other spouse. Interestingly, it was later revealed that the jury had first cast 8 votes for murder in the second degree versus 4 votes for manslaughter. Then, a half hour later, the vote was 8 for murder in the second degree and 4 in favor of manslaughter. Finally, just a few minutes later, the vote was unanimous for manslaughter. Bowder was given an opportunity to speak after the verdict was announced. Then, according to an article in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, quote, "He spoke freely about various aspects of the trial and its termination. He said that he blamed no one for the part that they had taken in the case," unquote. With the exception of 2 witnesses whom he felt had smeared his character and had told, quote, "foul lies about him," unquote. One of these witnesses was the Cleveland police detective named Schmidt, who had kindly suggested to Bowder to just let Jenny go when she first ran away rather than chase after her. Bowder was, quote, "especially bitter," unquote, in speaking about this officer. The judge sentenced Bowder to 10 years in prison. Andrew's mother was at the trial, and she loudly and repeatedly expressed her anger in regard to the guilty verdict, and her belief that her son had been convicted on the basis of false testimony by the witnesses for the prosecution. She eventually calmed down, saying,
"Well, never mind. We shall only have to get him pardoned out."
However, if she ever made such an effort, it was unsuccessful. On February 16, 1871, while awaiting transfer to prison, Bowder wrote a letter to his father.
"Dear Father, I will be here until the 23rd or 24th of this month, before I go to Columbus. I don't want you or anyone else to bother about me, since I have already caused you a great deal of trouble and expense, and I have been a disgrace to the family and to myself. And, though my intentions were for the best, it has resulted otherwise. I can find no fault with anyone, yet I am to suffer the penalty of the law for an unconscious act, and to be thankful that I did not get worse. If I had been friendless and had no one to look to my interests, I would have been tried long ago, and undoubtedly have been hung. And that, for an act that I was not accountable for. But I have made up my mind to make the best of it, and to do the best I know how. And, as I consider myself of little or no benefit in the present, it might be for the best that I might pick up and be myself again. The thought of the penitentiary is worse than the reality. And by the time I go through that, I think I will be satisfied, and more too. Then I will begin to think that I have been through the mill, and have seen the elephant, and will give up the idea of seeing more. My respects to the family, and also to all inquiring friends. I am well, and my mind is contented, to what it has been for months. I hope that these few lines will find you well also. Your affectionate son, A.J. Bowder."
On February 25th, 1871, Bowder arrived at the prison and began serving his sentence. It is unknown as to whether he served the full 10 years, which would have ended in 1881, or if he had any sort of early release. The only remaining thing which we do know for certain is that on December 19, 1884, Andrew Bowder died from tuberculosis at the age of 43 in Cleveland, Ohio. And on that note, we have now reached the end of our story.
Oh my gosh. What a story. I am just blown away. Okay, what did you guys think?
I have a lot of questions about this case, and about Andrew Bowder's story, I guess. My first question is, why was he so upset with the police officer who told him to leave Jenny alone? Was he mad because he was right? He should have let Jenny alone. He should have just let her go. My second question is, why did he feel so compelled to chase after her? Was he that much in love with her? What is it about people who chase after people who don't want them? Why is that a thing? Don't do that. That should just be a blanket lesson for everybody. If somebody don't want you, let them go. Let them go. Don't chase. No chasing. You're not a dog after a car running down the street. You know what I mean? Goodness gracious. Come on, Andrew Bowder. My third question is, did he ever remarry or have a relationship once he got out of jail? I mean, I guess we'll never know, since his sentence supposedly ended in 1881 and he died in 1884. There was 3 years there where something could have happened, but those are my questions about the Andrew Bowder case. Poor Jenny. She was just trying to get away and live her life. He should just let her go.
Points are being made. But it's crazy how different our opinions are. This story, honestly, just left me with this wow feeling. And not a good wow. The fact that Jenny was so manipulative and basically was playing Andrew from the beginning just upsets me so much. And the fact that he continually took her back, that just floors me. But she... I don't want to say she deserved it, because no one deserves being shot, but seriously, you can tell that it screams crime of passion. Honestly, this story left me speechless and a little angry.
Grr.
Points are being made. Points are being made. And I sort of agree with both of you. Jenny and Andrew were almost a perfect match for each other, in a weird kind of way. I mean, he was a guy who was so naive and so trusting that he was easy for Jenny to manipulate and basically rob and make a total fool out of him. Because he had such blind love and obsession. But it was that same love and obsession that eventually led him to pull the trigger when he finally discovered and realized that Jenny was not the girl that he thought she was, or the girl that he wanted her to be.
Points are being made.
Yes, and I think that we could talk about this story literally all day. However, I don't think that our listeners would have enough time or patience for that. So, I think it's time to move on.
But before we move on, we want to give an enormous thanks to our wonderful narrator, Jessica Malone. Honestly, you did an amazing job.
I absolutely agree. Jessica, I think that you gave one of the best narrations that we have ever had on this podcast.
And now, we would like to thank our guest voices on the featured story. Please take a bow and tell our audience anything that you would like them to know about you.
I'm true crime historian Richard O. Jones, exploring the scandals, scoundrels, and scourges of the past through historic newspaper accounts in the golden age of yellow journalism at www.truecrimehistorian.com.
Hello, my name is Lex Zorn. I'm based in Carmel, Indiana. I've been an actor for 11 years, and you can check me out on all social media at L-E-C-Z-O-R-N, and you can check me out under my name at IMDb.
Hiya, I'm Squirrelfeed, and you've heard me on the Forgotten News podcast as well as Rooster Teeth's hit show, Ruby. I'm available for all your oral needs. From cartoons to commercials, holiday greetings to audiobooks, if you need audio, feel free to come to me. You can get in touch with me through my Patreon, Discord, Instagram, Fiverr, YouTube, or Twitter accounts. You can also simply message me on my website or shoot me an email. My Patreon, Instagram, YouTube, and Fiverr accounts all share the same name. Squirrelfeed. S-Q-U-I-R-E-L-F-E-E-D. My Discord is squirrelfeed #8526. My Twitter is @feedacorn, and my website is squirrelfeed.com. My email is squirrelfeed@gmail.com. Once again, that is squirrelfeed. I gotta go now. Catch you later.
Jeremy Collins of the podcast We Listen To Facebook group and host of the podcast by the same name.
Good day, my name is Jamil McKinney. I am a freelance voice actor, a stage actor, a classical singer, and a music producer from O'Fallon, Illinois. I enjoy every aspect of performing, so I wish to give my voice or any other skills that I have to aid anyone in any way that I can. That being said, if anyone wishes to contact me, whether it be for music, for vocals, or anything of the sort, as I do provide music for games and content. I am in a content creation team and have provided songs for quite a few games in my time. My email address is Sweet P, which is also my stage name. Sweet P, that's capital S, W-E-E-T, capital P, no space, 2021. @outlook.com. SweetPea2021@outlook.com.
Hi, this is Jerry Kokich. I'm a voice actor who's always working on my craft. My email address, should you wish to contact me, is jerrykokich@yahoo.com.
You can also find me on Facebook.
And I have a website at jerrykokichvoiceactor.weebly.com. Y'all have a nice day now.
Many, many thanks to everyone.
Thank you so much. Because honestly, it's a great, great honor to have your help.
Yes. Thanks, everyone.
We could not keep this podcast rolling without you guys. Thank you.
Okay, everyone. We will now move right along to the next segment of this episode. We will start by saying that for most people, a history book is the only in-depth connection that they will ever have to the famous men and women of the past. Or to be able to walk down the bright avenues and boulevards of yesteryear. But What if you are someone who would rather visit the side streets and back alleys of yesteryear, as well as the random people who inhabited them? Well, unfortunately, there are very few history books that will take you on that type of journey, or that will enable you to meet or even to know the names of those forgotten people from history. So that's where we come in.
One of the original goals of this podcast was to tell lost and obscure stories from history, such as, for example, true crime stories that never made it into any history book.
And now, listeners, on that note, we will move on to the latest edition of our regular segment, Police Blotter and Court News, in which we will bring you stories of small-time crooks and other random folks who, for one reason or another, ended up inside the machinery and pain of the judicial system 100 or more years ago.
But now, at this point, listeners, you may remember that we had originally decided that we would not include the police blotter segment on any episode in which there were three hosts rather than two, so as to avoid confusion or unnecessary extra length of an episode. However, we have decided to give it a try and see how it goes. And listeners, feel free to let us know what you think.
Now, this particular police blotter segment on this episode will be narrated for you exactly as it was written in a column published in the Cleveland Plain Dealer on Wednesday, October 23rd, 1867, in the words of the anonymous reporter that wrote it. You will hear about arrests and the aftermath of those arrests.
But please be aware that for most of the people mentioned in this column, it was very likely the only time that their name was ever printed in a newspaper, other than possibly their obituary.
Also, keep in mind that nearly all of these people are somebody's great-great-grandfather or grandmother.
Maybe even yours. However, before we begin the segment, we will mention two quick things. First, anytime that you hear any amount of money described in this segment, please be aware that $1 in 1867 is the equivalent of approximately $18 in the present day.
We will now give a short warning to our listeners. The stories that you will hear in this police blotter and court news segment are essentially a slice of life from the dusty street corners and dim alleys of history. So, on this particular segment, you will hear various mentions of drunkenness, violence, prostitution, and larceny, among other crimes. And listeners, for that reason, if you think that hearing about any of these things could possibly cause you to have a negative emotional reaction, then this segment might not be something that you should listen to. So, if that is the case, just skip ahead roughly 7 minutes from now, give or take a few, and this segment will be over.
And, by the way, parental discretion is strongly advised, since there are some portions of this segment which young ears probably should not be listening to.
Now, finally, with all of that having been said, here we go.
Police Blotter and Court News. please. Order.
Municipal Court, Cleveland, Ohio, October 23rd, 1867. Lizzie Hughes, charged with public intoxication. She is an old lady who got drunk on the night before last and had a lively quarrel with her niece, creating a public disturbance. She was fined $3 and court costs. Mary Birch, charged with vagrancy. Mary is a pretty girl, 20 years of age. She is an incorrigible little prostitute who has been out of the workhouse for only a short time. She has a respectable father who is anxious to have her return home and, quote, be a good girl, unquote. On Monday afternoon, Mary was seen by a policeman perambulating on Lake Street with one boy as a special escort and 12 other male followers. The judge talked to her like a father and then sentenced her to 3 months in the workhouse, but with fine waived. Martin Fallon, charged with assaulting policeman Ritiker. Mr. Fallon is a crippled man. The officer testified that he was walking through Irishtown late Sunday evening when he overheard Fallon trying to pick a fuss with another man. The policeman warned him to stop, which brought a defiant word from the defendant, whereupon he was arrested. After the policeman had taken him a short distance, James Fallon, the father of the defendant, rescued his son, after a rough-and-tumble fight with the officer, who was badly handled. The father and son were both afterwards arrested. The judge ordered their case to be continued until October the 25th. William Sale, charged with assault and battery. He is accused of entering a saloon on the corner of Green and Scoville Streets in a drunken haze. He then ordered a drink. However, because the proprietor declined to give any liquor to the drunken man, he struck and kicked him. Williams was fined $5 and court costs. Gottlieb Mühlhäuseler was charged with assault and battery. The plaintiff was George Hines, who was shockingly cut at Miller's Saloon on Seneca Street the night before last. The defendant claimed that Hines cut his wrist by dashing it through a window. The case was continued until October 25th. The defendant paid bail in the sum of $200 for his appearance at that time. James Latimer, charged with petty larceny. Latimer is a rough but honest-looking man. It would be difficult to exaggerate the importance of this case. The stolen property was a grain bag valued at several shillings. Of course, a brilliant display of legal intellect swarmed over the case. The plaintiff was Mr. Conrad, who was the street commissioner of this city. Conrad claimed that the defendant stole the bag from the feed box of one of his horse wagon drivers. The defendant, who is also a horse wagon driver but in the employ of Mr. Blair, acknowledged that he took the bag but claimed that it had been stolen from him by a boy in the employ of Conrad. The defendant testified that he knew the bag was his by a certain hole. And Mr. Conrad said he knew the bag was his by a certain hole. Latimer testified that he made the hole, and Conrad testified that he made the hole. The judge believed Latimer. Case dismissed.
I hereby declare this court is adjourned.
And that brings us to the end of the Police Blotter and Court News segment from October 23rd, 1867.
We hope that this short visit to some of the dark and dirty side streets of yesteryear was an educational and enlightening experience for you.
And with that having been said, we would like to express our deepest thanks to our guest narrator and guest voices on the Police Blotter segment. Please take a bow and tell our listeners a little about yourselves.
Hi, this is Moxie LaBouche from Your Brain on Facts, your guest narrator for today. If you enjoyed hearing the sound of my voice, please check out Your Brain on Facts on your favorite podcast app or at yourbrainonfacts.com.
I'm Sarah of the Good Nightmare Podcast, a podcast where I look at historical true crime, paranormal events, and the dark origin of fairy tales. You can find me on social media at goodnightmare_s.
This is Chris Hansen, a.k.a. the Carpenter Chris from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Avid podcast consumer and wanted to lend my voice as a way to give back to the community. In the past, I've been told I had a voice for radio. Or was it a face for radio? Either way, if you've got a part for me, let me know.
Thank you so much for your help, everyone, on this episode.
Thank you so much, guys. We really appreciate your contribution. Can't wait to hear you again on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. All of you, you did a wonderful job.
Now, listeners, we would very much like to be able to tell police blotter stories from the 19th century newspapers of your city or town.
So, if you have the time and ability, just send it to us by email.
And we promise to use it as soon as we can.
The address is forgottennewspodcast@gmail.com.
Next, we will now move on to our recommendations and advice segment. Jim, Kit Karen, and I will each take a few moments to mention something that we think our listeners might be interested in hearing about.
It might be a book, a movie, a TV show, a podcast, an app, a game, a food, a recipe, a product, a life hack, or who knows? It will always be something different. By the way, we want our listeners to know that we do not synchronize or discuss our comments or suggestions in regard to this segment before we record. That way, it's always a surprise for the listeners and for us.
This week, Jim will go first, then Kit, and finally, me, Jessica.
Listeners, my recommendation to you on this episode is a new podcast called Madison on the Air. And through the magic of the internet, I have the host, Madison, as my guest. Hello, Madison.
Sup?
Now, if I understand correctly, your show revolves around your adventures after a weird science experiment goes all wrong and you are somehow sent back in time and you thereupon become part of the episodes of random old-time radio shows, but like as though they are real life.
OMG, it's totes real life. After you've been stuck in a patrol car with Joe Friday for a day, let me just tell you, the stench be real.
Madison, you probably don't know this, but our show occasionally features episodes of old-time radio shows, and obviously that is one of the reasons that I am recommending your podcast. Those episodes of our show have gotten a terrific response from our listeners. And I think that anyone who loves old-time radio would love your show also.
Yes! So, like, every episode I go to a different old-timey radio show and, like, help out, you know, like, solving crimes and stuff. I usually partner up with someone like Marshall MacDillan, Sam Spade. Ooh, I filled in for Robin. Like, Batman and Robin with Superman. Flying with Superman is nothing like it's portrayed in the comics. So I kind of get to compare the old-timey ways to today. Like, they don't have Starbucks. My iPhone gets zero reception. Nobody is PC.
Well, Madison, thanks for joining me on my recommendation segment. I have no idea how you managed to join us here from back in the 1940s, but it was lots of fun, and I hope that all of our listeners tune into your show. Madison, on the air.
Yeah, like, I have no idea if this is all, like, a glitch in the Matrix or what, but I am having a blast. But hey, if anybody out there can snag me a mocha latte, I would totes love you forever. Okay, thanks, Jim. Bye.
Goodbye.
So, my recommendation for this episode is something that I do a lot. It is an app called Happy Color, and it's basically where you can color pictures on your phone. It's kind of like a paint by numbers type of thing, so that makes it easier. It's an adult coloring app, and gotten a lot of enjoyment, and I find coloring to be soothing because I don't always have a coloring book or, you know, colored pencils or crayons handy. It's nice to just be able to do it on my phone, and it's a free app. You can get it on the App Store or on Google Play. So that's nice. It's not particularly Apple. You can do it for Android, too. But yeah, I've really grown accustomed to it. There's a lot of cool pictures. And it's just a great way to use your time to, like, relax. Yeah, so you should check it out. If you like coloring, you want to do something, like, not necessarily meditative, but something that could give you a relaxing attitude. I mean, what adult does not like to color?
This week, I am recommending the HBO series The Undoing, starring Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant. Hugh Grant is excellently cast as a bad husband, and Donald Sutherland reminds us he's one of the greatest actors of our time in this murder mystery that will keep you on the edge of your seat as we twist and turn our way through this thriller that promises to keep you engaged. Plus, it's only 6 episodes, so it's not a huge time commitment. If you like a good mystery, if you like a thriller, if you like a good whodunit, check out The Undoing on HBO.
And that is the end of the recommendation and advice segment for this episode.
But listeners, if you have a suggestion for something that you would like us to mention on this segment, just send us an email. And if it's a good recommendation, we will definitely pass it along to our audience.
Okay, everyone. We are now at the part of the episode where we ask you to give us a review on Apple Podcasts, also known as iTunes, as well as anywhere else that lets you post a review for podcasts.
But please, only 5-star reviews.
Honestly, listeners, nothing less than 5 stars. Please.
I know that sometimes we sound like we are just kidding around when we ask you to give us a 5-star review and nothing except a 5-star review. But in reality, the truth is we are actually very serious because every 5-star review for the Forgotten News podcast helps other people to find the show, and that way they can hear the stories that we share with you. And not only that, every 5-star review helps to give us a boost in the rankings.
So it would mean a lot to us if you would take a minute of your time and write a 5-star review for the Forgotten News podcast. Please, it would be so sweet of you. And thank you in advance for doing that.
Now, even if you don't want to write a review, you should always feel free to contact us. Let us know what you think.
Just send us an email to forgottennewspodcast@gmail.com.
Please, tell us how we're doing. Don't force us to just wonder.
You can also interact with us on Facebook and Twitter. Just type Forgotten News Podcast in the search box, and the name should come right up.
You can also contact me on Twitter. I'd love to talk to you about anything. My handle is @KitKaren. I will spell that for you. @KitCaren. However, be sure to type that as if it were all one word. Now, listeners, I want you to know I like hearing from you. In fact, I absolutely want to hear from you. Honestly, I really do. All that I ask is just be nice, don't be salty, and I will reply. I really will. Be good to me, and I'll be good to you. That is how relationships are supposed to work, right? Give and take. It's that simple.
And
it's all you really need to know. Be good, and I'll be good to you.
Listeners,
you can reach me on all social media platforms at XOXOJessicaXOXO.
Okay.
Hey, Jessica. Hey, Jim. I need to tell you something, and it's really shocking. You'll never believe it. We are at the end of the episode. Hey, it's true. Stop looking at me like I've lost my mind. This is not a joke. Honest, we're at the end. I'm sorry, but we are.
So, in other words, what you're saying is, we need to wrap it up.
Yes, Jim.
Hold on. There is one more thing. Listeners, this is so important. Wear a mask. Wash your hands whenever you have a chance. Avoid large gatherings and stay at least 6 feet away from anyone you don't live with.
Stay safe, and you'll stay alive.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye, everyone.
And remember, history is no mystery. Dum 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 dum, la 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 la, bum bum bum. This episode was recorded before a live audience of
us.
Thank you for listening to the Forgotten News Podcast. You will now be returned back to the present day, and we hope that we can count on you to join us for our next episode.
Okay, everyone. Back to you at the studio.
Bye.